Music from Eric Nelson, Picking Up the Pieces. And before that, from Dick and Mel Tunney, Seekers of Your Heart. At 11 minutes after 8, it's time to greet Doug Greenwald. Doug is a senior teaching fellow and executive director of Preserving Bible Times. He's based in Columbia, Maryland, just on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. And Doug knows a lot about Passion Week. Don't you, Doug?
Well, I do that. And speaking of Washington, D.C., it's cherry blossom season.
Oh, can you see them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They've been out strongly for at least a week.
Okay. Well, see, we're looking at snow in southern Minnesota today, and we got temperatures in the 20s. No cherry blossoms here. I envy you.
Well, I've heard of people who actually live like you do, and now I actually have met two of you.
Yes, you have.
Well, we're the only two, though.
There's only two of us in East Dakota at the moment.
I thought the sun always shone in East Dakota, you know, warm enough to melt the ice.
Well, it does.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Actually, we've seen very little of the sun for the past few weeks. And today, though, with fair skies, so we're looking forward to a little sunshine today.
We're the only two that are left that live like this, and we'd like to keep it that way.
Yeah. So don't tell anybody, Doug.
If you're planning on visiting, just send your money and we'll send you a postcard.
Well, it must be easy to have a caucus then if they're just the two of you.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, we don't have to meet.
Yeah. We each have a cup of coffee and that's true. We can just twit each other here.
Yep. And, you know, somebody has to be there to fill out the paperwork. That's about it.
Doug, last week we talked about the arrival of Jesus down from the Mount of Olives on a donkey, and how he went to the temple, and how he drove out the money changers and the animals, and how this uproarious crowd that was there to welcome him were so eagerly anticipating the Messiah because of a lot of things. The whole culture had been groomed or trained or was in kind of an expectant state, weren't they, at that point?
Well, absolutely, for a number of reasons. Jesus is now definitely the Messiah. The raising of Lazarus on the fourth day made that clear to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Messiah comes, the rabbis have pretty much generally agreed upon, this is how we'll recognize him. He'll go straight to the temple, set up his throne and reign politically and militarily, and bring about prosperity, peace, and social justice. And so that's the expectation.
And they were high expectations.
And I think the disciples are in on that expectation. Mm-hmm. That's why Peter is packing metal, a knife, even in Gethsemane, cut off the ear of the servant.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back just today here, because they were on their way up from Jericho, and the story of Zacchaeus had happened, and Jesus and presumably his disciples had spent the night at Zacchaeus' house, and Jesus commented then that he had to explain to the crowd that this was going to take some time. This wasn't going to be an instant change, and so he was trying to control the crowd even then, wasn't he?
Well, he was, and I think it points out how difficult it is to communicate to people who have a fixed paradigm of what they think is going to happen and how they think it's going to happen. I mean, just look at how Republicans and Democrats try to talk to each other. You know, they're each is locked into their own paradigm, their own view of the world. And so I think Jesus said a lot of these things, and it seemed pretty clear to us through the rearview mirror. But it was always heard and interpreted within a fixed paradigm of what they thought Messiah was going to be like.
Well, they were anxious. They were tired of oppression. They were sick of the Romans. And they didn't like the religious establishment in Jerusalem. They didn't trust them either. They knew corruption when they saw it. So they wanted change now. And Jesus kept saying, no, this is going to take a while. This is not quite what you think, not quite what you picture.
Well, you know, they've been waiting for quite a while. Pompey and the Roman 10th Legion came into the land in 63 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And Rome is viewed as the kingdom of evil.
So 90 years before, they've been under
the thumb. By an observant Jew, and Satan is the chief operating officer of Rome in their view. And so who wouldn't want overthrow? Who wouldn't want revolution? I mean, it's the righteous thing to aspire for.
Mm-hmm. Well, they saw things crumbling and wanted it fixed. And Jesus seemed like the likely candidate. Indeed, he was the candidate. He was the Messiah. But they had different expectations. Now, a lot is made of his trip into Jerusalem and his time at the temple and cleansing the temple. What happened next? Because the story kind of gets quiet there, and all of a sudden we're at the Last Supper. Where did they go, for example? After, I mean, there's this crowd, there's this, all the hullabaloo at the temple, and then they just walk out?
Well, some would argue that Monday and Tuesday are, let's call them, the teaching days.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday is absolutely silent. There's some speculation as to what might have happened on Wednesday. And, of course, Thursday, Maundy Thursday, Good mm-hmm. Friday, we know the sequence from there. So I'd say the early part of that week, after this going to the temple experience on Palm Sunday, is time with his disciples, time teaching, maybe on the southern teaching steps of the Temple Mount. And then Wednesday is silent, and then from Thursday on, we kind of know how the week ends up.
But tradition is called for a Seder supper at that point, because they're there for Passover. That's the reason they've come to Jerusalem. And Jesus gives some explicit instructions, because the disciples want to know, how we're gonna do dinner tonight? Yeah, where do you want to go for dinner, Jesus? And he had a very specific answer for them. There's more to that, I think, than just what we see on the surface.
Well, we've got two calendars at work. We've got the lunar calendar and the solar calendar, and they're off by a day in this particular year of Jesus' death and resurrection. So I think we have him doing some portion of the Seder meals. Argue it really wasn't a Seder meal because one of the phases is missing, one of the cups is missing. That's a whole argument by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But he's celebrating Passover and the Paschal Lamb on one calendar, and then the next day he switches to another calendar and he becomes the Paschal Lamb. So that's kind of intriguing all by itself, because we have the Essene calendar at work, as well as the observant Jewish calendar at work during this week. And each of those viewpoints sees things differently, has a different calendar that they're adhering to.
Mm-hmm. Now, who were the Essenes and where were the Essenes?
Well, the Essenes were a sect who, several decades before the moment we find ourselves in right now.
You mean a sect like the Sadducees or like the Pharisees?
Well, a little bit bigger than the Sadducees. Sadducees mm-hmm. are pretty small. Probably somewhere between the small size of the Sadducees and the 6,000 members of the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
But they had so had it with the fusion of the high priesthood and the king of Israel that the Hasmoneans had done, and the way that the Rome had sort of took that over and made the high priest a franchise that you bought annually, you know, with kickbacks to Rome, that they basically said, we're out of here. We're going to withdraw. We're going to isolate ourselves. We want nothing more to do with this profound corruption of the temple leadership. And so they go down to Qumran, down in the wilderness of Judea, and set up their community. And it's a celibate community. They're only men. There are no women in the Essene community. And you ask yourself, well, how do you survive if you're only men? Well, you bring in orphans. And tradition says that John the Baptist actually was one of the orphans that was brought into the Essene community at Qumran, because Zechariah and Elizabeth were really old.
They were elderly, yeah.
When John the Baptist was born. And so probably John was an orphan before he was even a teenager. So there's that tradition. Well, I think it's 29 AD. It was a huge earthquake in that part of Israel, and it wiped out the Essene community. And at about the same time, one of the Essene elders made a very favorable prophecy to Herod the Great, who was fairly new in his reign at that time, that Herod the Great would have a long and prosperous reign. And Herod liked that prophecy so much that he gave to the Essenes, who now don't have their community because of the earthquake, a significant portion of real estate in Jerusalem, which by the time of Jesus now has become known as the Essene Quarter. And if you go to the Israel Museum and you walk around the big model, outdoor model of Jerusalem in the first century, you see that this Essene quarter is down in the southwest quadrant of, but within the city walls of Jerusalem in the first century. And in that model, there actually is a monastery that they've created, the Essene Monastery. It's the biggest building in the Essene Quarter. And most thinking is that Jesus, trying to get away from the pressure of the crowds, decides to go hang out in the neighborhood of the Essenes, where his cousin, John the Baptist, was raised, and is then doing this semi-Seder, full-Seder meal, pick your viewpoint here, in a room, which we know is the upper room, in the Essene Quarter Monastery.
Now, the Essenes were particularly hospitable to travelers. Didn't they have that reputation?
I would say no more so than any other portion of Judaism here, because it doesn't matter whether you're an Essene or a Pharisee or an observant Jew or Hellenistic Jew, social hospitality, mandatory hospitality is just everywhere. And so, you know, to say that they're more particularly oriented that way than any other, I think would be an error. But let's put it this way. They may be much more hospitable and open to orphans.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And embracing of orphans and bringing them into their community.
Mm-hmm. How did, now the disciples asked where they were going to go. And Jesus told them to look for a man carrying water. That sounds a little cryptic.
Well, a lot is said in that statement, because in this culture, women carry the water, not the men. Hmm. And the only reason a man would carry water is if there aren't any women in that particular subculture. Uh-huh. And that's certainly true of the Essenes. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get our main clue that the Last Supper took place in the Essene Quarter.
Interesting. And from that point on, events accelerated. I mean, there's a quiet time there, and Jesus and the disciples head back out toward the Mount of Olives after the dinner, and then that's where everything in the garden happens. Pick up the sequence for us from there.
Well, I'm just going to vignette certain aspects of the last days of Jesus here, and I want to start in John 18, verse 27. In fact, let me go back to verse 26. We're talking about Peter's denial of Jesus. And one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the olive grove?" Meaning Gethsemane. Mm-hmm. And again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. That's a translation in most of our Bibles. What's fascinating about that is give a little insight into translational history here. At the temple, at certain times of the day, they blow the shofar horn. And the shofar horn emits a sound that's sort of like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that sound is known as kakro. They blow the horn at kakro. And so the first time in the day that the shofar horn blows kakro is early in the morning when temple gates are open and worship liturgies can commence. Now, through the years, kakro became separated into kakros. Mm-hmm. In translational history. And you can now see the next incremental step that can easily take place. Cock crows, well, let's translate that rooster crows for the Western world. And quite a bit got lost in that those little micro mistranslations. Because for a rooster to crow is one thing, but for cock crow to be heard is entirely something else, because Peter has denied Jesus three times. He's lied. He has sinned. He is ritually unclean. He is forbidden from going to worship until he goes through the ritual purification baths, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so to hear the sound that worship is now commencing in the temple shortly after daybreak, is a reminder to him of how unclean he is. The word kakro brings that added weightiness to this scene that is entirely different from what we would see.
It's an invitation to Peter that he could not respond to then.
Sorry?
It's an invitation for Peter that he can't respond to.
Exactly. And that's when it comes crashing over him that he is unclean, that he has failed his master.
Now see, that's powerful now. That's much
more. It is, and he's forbidden from worship until he gets purified through the purification baths. Mm. So that I always like this little example. It's a classic example of how a word can be slightly mishandled over, you know, hundreds of years, and we end up with something in our Bible that is has much less gravitas, much less weightiness to it in our contextual understanding than was intended to be.
And the same applies. Now, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but I'm thinking of Jesus' last words. That's another example of lost gravitas.
Yeah, well, let's close out with that.
Okay.
Rather than do that at the moment here, because one of the things that I want us to take a look at here is the chess match that's going on. Let's call it 5,000 feet here. Everybody wants, well, the temple establishment wants Jesus gone, but they don't want to have any fingerprints on it, because they know the people loves Jesus. And they're worried about a riot and the loss of their franchise if they're seen as being complicit into the death of Jesus. Pilate is on probation from Rome, and his job is to keep the lid on this place, because Israel is viewed as a buffer zone between the Roman Empire and the Parthians, who they fear. And so he's trying to maneuver himself so that whatever happens to Jesus, he's not the fall guy for it, okay?
Now, had he lost his sponsor by then, because the emperor that appointed him was assassinated?
Well, the emperor didn't appoint him. A proxy for the emperor, Sejanus.
Yes, Sejanus.
Appointed him, who was really running the empire in absentia for Tiberius, who sort of exiled himself off to Villa Jovis, which is on a high peak on the Isle of Capri. South in the Bay of Naples there. And when Sejanus supposedly made a move to take over the Praetorian Guard and put that under his responsibility, Tiberius' sister, who continued to live in Rome, informed Tiberius that she thought a coup d'etat was taking place. And Tiberius subscribed to that theory and laid a trap and captured and killed Sejanus. So Pilate, who was appointed by Sejanus, is now gone, and this is all within the last 6 to 9 months. So Pilate's got a new boss, Tiberius, and he doesn't know how he views all these issues of anti-Semitism and Israel and what have you, so he's kind of walking on eggshells. One more mistake by Pilate, and he's no longer going to be a governor, a procreator, and the last thing that Pilate wants is for the Jewish establishment to be so angry with how he handles Jesus that they send a group to Rome and say bad things about him. So he's concerned with how can I not only keep the lid on this situation, but keep the Jewish establishment loyal to me. And in the midst of all this, Herod Antipas shows up in Jerusalem. And he has jurisdiction over the Galilean district of Israel. And Pilate says, aha, this is how I can dodge this bullet. I'm going to send this Yeshua, Jesus, to Herod Antipas. He's the one who killed Jesus's cousin, John the Baptist, and put him under his jurisdiction, and maybe he'll kill him. And I'll be clean. Well, Herod Antipas is smart enough to know I'm not going to get caught up in this one. So he immediately, within an hour, sends Jesus back to Pilate. And so Pilate has got to deal with this situation one more time. And how to keep the lid on this situation and the Jewish leadership under his thumb. And so there's a negotiation that takes place, and we see it in John 19. And in verse 12 of John 19, from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be king opposes Caesar." So part of the backdrop to this is the Sejanus coup was seen as sedition by Tiberius. And immediately after he put Sejanus to death, he sent out an edict that sedition was not to be tolerated anywhere in the empire. The moment you sniff out even the faintest aroma of sedition, crush it. And the Jews know this, the Jewish leadership. And so now they're trying to paint Jesus as a seditionist, mm-hmm. because that will force Pilate to have to kill Jesus. Okay? Their real complaint with Jesus is blasphemy. He's claiming to be Messiah, but that doesn't mean anything to Rome. It's a polytheistic society. What's another god? And so they've switched their attack here and are now pushing sedition. Hence this, anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. Translation, you got to deal with this. You got to put him to death. Hmm. Pilate, okay? Oh, okay, and we go down here. Here is your king, Pilate says to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." And Pilate says, "Shall I crucify your king?" He says this to the Jewish establishment. And here is the key verse, and here's where I'm heading. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered, John 19:18. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Do you see how the chess match unfolds here? Do you see the great negotiation? And finally, Pilate got the allegiance of the Jewish leadership to say, "We have no king but Caesar." Now he's under his control, so now he'll kill Jesus. He's got a lid on the situation. Can you imagine the chief priest and the high priest saying, "We have no king but Caesar"?
That is darn near blasphemy itself.
Oh, it's almost beyond blasphemy. But that's what's going on. There is not an ounce of religiosity in the leadership in Jerusalem of the temple and of the Sanhedrin. Okay?
They're really a secular administration, aren't they?
It is. It's a Wall Street operation.
Yeah.
As now, I said a couple weeks ago, Temple Incorporated is the combination of Walmart and Wall Street. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's a giant economic cash-generating cow, and these guys have sold their souls to run it, and they pay a kickback to Rome every year to keep it going, and that's part of the backdrop to hear this whole negotiation process.
Now, just a word about who these people were shouting, "Crucify him," because there's a lot of confusion about crowds, to call the crowd, and there was a crowd that welcomed Jesus. Now there's a crowd that's saying, "Crucify him." And the logical question is, why the change?
Well, we have to go back and realize that the reason the establishment here, the temple aristocracy, is doing all this stuff at night and holding a kangaroo court as soon as day breaks is because they want all of this nasty stuff out of the way before the hundreds of thousands of people who are in the greater Jerusalem area get word of this. They know the crowds love Jesus. Now, part of our issue here is translational as well. The word translated crowd simply means a group of people. There's not a lot of versatility in the language here to determine what kind of the size of the crowd. And this whole thing is taking place in either one of two places, the courtyard of Herod's palace, or one of the inner chambers, courtyards of the Antonio Fortress, which is in the northwest corner of Temple Mount. And there are probably 200 to 300 people in this particular crowd very early in the morning. They've been handpicked by the Jerusalem establishment. They've been coached what to scream when, what to yell at a certain moment in time. And this is the crowd that is yelling, "Crucify him, crucify him." It's no more than several hundred people, probably not even that large. It's not the 200,000 people who are probably in Jerusalem and the suburbs of Jerusalem for Passover at this moment in time. They love Jesus. They've always loved Jesus. Whenever Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor," 90% of the people in this land are dirt poor. They were immediately on Jesus' side. And so part of the mistranslation that actually has given rise to all kinds of anti-Semitic acts through the centuries is that when John uses the phrase the Jews, he's referring to the aristocracy. And people have read it through the years saying the Jews and think it applies to a nation. Or let's put it this way, a group of people with a certain DNA. And that contextual misunderstanding does a couple of things. Points out why context does matter, okay? And points out the dangers that take place when we leave context behind and mistranslate and misunderstand passages. When John uses the phrase the Jews, he uses it in a technical way, which is always within the context of Jewish leadership, not the people. And that has been misunderstood through the years as a reason to persecute the Jews because they're the ones who killed Messiah. That's just a, I'd say unfortunate is just too weak of a word. It's just a terrible fallout from misunderstanding context here that has wreaked havoc on the Jewish nation for centuries.
I have a question, a short, curiosity thing. Was there any kind of leader to? Was there any kind of leader to people understanding between the leader, the religious leaders of the day, and the people they supposedly led? And was Pilate's bringing the leadership under his control, was that an attempt to separate them from their followers?
The Jewish aristocracy has no followers. Everybody knows they're absolutely corrupt.
Okay.
But you still have to go to the temple to become righteous in the system, and they control the temple, so you put up with it.
Yeah, so you live with it. All right.
Now, remember, I'm only talking about the aristocracy. There are 15,000 to 20,000 ordinary priests who are running the infrastructure of the temple. They're really good people, okay? Mm-hmm. The Zacharias of the world. So, I mean, we're probably not talking more than 100 to 200 people when we say the Jerusalem aristocracy.
Mm. And the 15,000 of good, solid priests are in the more or less the same boat, that they realize the leadership is corrupt.
Absolutely.
But they're putting it up with it as well. Okay.
It's kind of like you work for a multinational corporation that employs 10,000 people, and everyone knows you got lousy leadership, but you still go to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just make an observation on scourging here, and then we'll finish up with last words. There is a phrase from a Roman perspective that says, give him 40 lashes. That's code word for scourge him, whip him, deflesh him until he's dead. So when Pilate says, give Jesus 39 lashes, he's saying, scourge him, whip him, until he's 95% dead. Remember now, this is taking place on Friday, and Passover takes place at sunset. And so this has got to be a rapid death. And so a way to speed this process up is to really scourge them. And I think one of the things we miss, when you're scourged, you're basically being defleshed. I mean, there are these leather straps that have bone fragments and metal fragments in it, and they're meant to tear the flesh and the muscle off your back. And so when Jesus is submitted to 39 lashes, that means whatever it takes. It doesn't mean specifically 39. It means however many it takes to get him almost near death. And so one of the reasons that Simon Cyrene has to help pick up the crossbar is because Jesus no longer has control over his shoulders and his arms. Those muscles have been just ripped off his back in the scourging process. And he's almost dead already. I think we think most of his dying took place on the cross. Now, that's just where the last 5 or 10% of it took place. But he has been brought almost very close to death by the time he is taken from the scourge, the site of the scourging, and taken to Golgotha. And then we deal with the last words of Jesus. where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And a typical Western way of looking at that passage is to say, well, it must mean what it says. Let's just take it literally. So it must be that Jesus was forsaken by God. And then somehow, in a derivation history I've not been able to put my finger on, forsaken has also come to mean abandoned. And so a typical message you will hear, a typical explanation you will hear during Passion Week goes like this. There's Jesus hanging on the cross, bearing all the sins that were, are, and ever will be. It is such a horrible sight that a holy God cannot view it, turns his back on his only begotten Son, and breaks the eternity of the Trinitarian fellowship. And therein lies the real pain of Calvary. And I think if you read those words and take them literally, that's the only explanation you can come up with. But I would suggest to you that to a Jew near the base of the cross, when Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? His first thought would be, oh, that's from Psalm 22. In fact, it's the very first verse exactly from Psalm 22. And in this culture, we have a communication technique called remez, R-E-M-E-Z. It's when you deliberately hearken back to something, just a few words, and everybody knows where those few words have come from, and therefore they will import the full weight, the full understanding of where those few words came from as to what you're trying to say. And so Jesus is about to die, has almost no energy left, can't make a long benediction, a long final statement, a closing prayer. And so, being a rabbi, he's going to speak in shorthand. Because that's what rabbis do. They speak in remez. So you say a little phrase, and everybody knows what the big meaning is from the shorthand that you've just used. And so Jesus is basically saying, when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's invoking all of Psalm 22 as his final statement. That's how I would suggest a Jew would have understood it. Jesus is a rabbi. He functions as a rabbi. He teaches like a rabbi. He communicates like a rabbi. And here he's able, using the rabbinic teaching technique of remez, to say a little.
Oh, we lost your mic. There you go.
Well, several years ago in Jerusalem, we heard about a rabbi who was teaching that Psalms 22, 23, and 24 in the first century would have been viewed by the Jews as a unitized whole. You can't break them apart like we've done in our Bibles. And whoa, that just really took my breath away. Because if that's true, and there's a good indication that it is, then by invoking Psalm 22:1 as his last words, Jesus is invoking the totality of Psalms 22, 23, and 24 as his final statement. So I would suggest to your listeners, sometime in the next few days, read Psalms 22, 23, and 24 from Jesus' perspective. He has identified with those psalms long before we did. Psalm 22 goes in quite explicit detail as to how he is actually dying on the cross.
It's written from the perspective of a man dying on the cross.
Absolutely.
That's astounding, because that method of death wasn't used at the time David wrote that.
That's part of what makes it even more amazing. And then Psalm 23, lo, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. No notion of abandonment here. Psalm 24, throw open the gates of heaven, the King of glory returns, which is where he's headed. Okay? And this argument that God can't look upon sin, it isn't the amount of sin that he can't look at. What God is looking at sin all the time. What God cannot do is countenance sin, approve of sin. I mean, he goes eyeball to eyeball with the epitome of evil, Satan, in Job, okay? And setting aside the fact that God has a back that he can turn on his son, and somehow we also have to set aside that theologically we teach the forever oneness of the Trinity can never be broken. I mean, the whole, I would suggest, traditional way that this has been taught us and preached to us is weak. And there's a whole nother way to look at this from a linguistic context point of view, namely Remez, which takes us to an entirely different place, and for me, makes a whole lot more sense.
And, you know, when I read Psalms 22, 23, and 24, I see his death, his comforting, and his victory in those three psalms. And seeing it in this light makes this an incredibly much more powerful story than ever I have been taught in church.
It absolutely does. And let me just read from Jesus' own words from John 16, 32, Upper Room Discourse, okay? But a time is coming and has come when you all will be scattered, each to his own home. You will leave me alone, yet I am not alone, for my Father is with me. Okay? He's even told him he's not going to be abandoned by his Father.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are people who literally want to go to war over this way of viewing the last words of Jesus, because it's been taught traditionally for so long. And, you know, if I can be gentle about it and I can break in to their monologue of concern, I'll simply, you know, why are you so hung up on abandonment? Why do you have to insist that God abandon his son? The efficaciousness, the effectiveness of Calvary is in the blood, not the abandonment, okay? It's the blood that cleanses us. So, you know, to give up on the notion of abandonment does not compromise what happened at the cross at all.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, a ministry based near Washington, been around for, 15 to 20 years now, and specializing, thankfully, beautifully, in a most welcome way, in the context, the historic and cultural context of Scripture. There's a link to Preserving Bible Times. It's a gorgeous website, by the way. Link right on our Broken Road Radio website. Click on that. It'll take you there to preservingbibletimes.org. And you'll discover just a wealth of resources for your own personal study, for your church libraries, for your Bible studies and small groups. It's an astounding ministry and one that we're so thankful for here, Doug, that you join us every Wednesday and teach us. Thank you.
Well, I'm about to send out a reflection for Good Friday tomorrow on Barabbas. And so if you're... some of your listeners are not on the mailing list yet and would like it, just sign up or send us an email and we'll shoot you a copy of that Good Friday reflection.
And that doesn't cost you anything either. It just comes by email every month. You look forward to it. And sometimes you even get more than one a month, and it'll light up your day. It really will. And Doug, maybe we can talk about Barabbas next week. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. We will indeed. Doug, have a great day. A marvelous Easter. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Shalom, shalom. In fact, this year, Easter shalom.
Shalom. Bye-bye.